photographs today, I guess.
Media.
All media photographs.
Address of narrator. Birth year. Wait. Oh, address. You have us all. All right. I have to put this down here. In a what?
Like a fizzy water?
No, I'm fine. Thank you. I just had a Chadburn Hall breakfast, so.
Oh, nice.
So if you want to, the date of the agreement is 06, what day is today?
Today's the
15th.
15th? Yep.
All right, so 2018.
All right, so this is Sky Domi sitting down with Chris Hexter on June 15th, 2018. Mr. Hexter is in town for the Madison reunion and is going to tell us a few Mossy stories.
So you want me just to...
Yeah, if you want to just narrate. Or...
Well, all right. My father's an historian. His name's Jack H. Hexter. And my father was at Washington U in St. Louis in 1961-62, among other places he'd been. And he was... former chair of the department. His field is British history, 16th and 17th century. And at that time, Professor Mossy was a Renaissance Reformation historian, and he was invited to Wash U to speak. And he stayed at our house, visited. And he already struck an impression on me, enough so that when I applied to various colleges and universities in the Midwest, I remembered him after I had gone to Iowa City. I came up to Madison, and I remembering him, I thought I'd talk to him about coming here. And he was very gracious. He was in an office, a very unpretentious office, which he shared with another. I think he may have shared it with Professor Petrovich, but it was like crowded with stuff.
Which building was that?
In Bascom Hall, on the south side of Bascom Hall. And he was very gracious. He took me to lunch, took me through the Rathskeller, where there were graduate students of his. He introduced me to Paul Brynäs, which was, for me, a somewhat intimidating experience because I was then a senior in high school. And while we were walking down to the Union, he asked me what schools I applied to. And I had just come from Iowa City, where I had met some students, one of whom had graduated from my high school. And Iowa seemed wonderful to me because, I was introduced to beer and drinking. So this sounded great. And the library is open 24 hours. And we were playing PDQ Bach. I thought, Iowa City, that's where I'm going to go. And so when Professor Mossy asked me where I'd applied, I mentioned the University of Iowa. I have a Cal College. So I thought, wow. And I didn't know his background at that point. So anyway, we met. And then when I came up to UW, I took his introduction, I think it was a modern European history class, and Paul had already left.
Oh, wow.
Paul had gone over to Germany, but Professor Mossy, in addition to doing the lectures, which were pretty impressive, out at the Ag building, which is where he tended to have these classes, he ran one section himself. He always maintained, and I think it was just nice he had me in the section. And it was just a very, he was an engaged, here we were, a bunch of 18, 19-year-old students, and he was just an engaged guy. And so I it was very impressive. I remember his dog, I think Schnutzy, who was always around him. We went to his house on, Glenwood,
yeah.
I think. In
37 Glenwood.
Yeah, and so, let me think through this a little bit. I do remember, among other things, Professor Mossy, which is, I think, an interesting mistake on his part, which he was prepared, as former Chancellor Ward talked about. He thought that the great thing, which I do think of great universities, are and my favorite universities are these great state universities, which are a treasure. And he thought they would become the dominant force in the United States. Well, it's turned out they're subject to such political pressures that, you know, as we know in Wisconsin, and not, it's not unique to Governor Walker, but it is a problem that all state universities have, that their subsidies are under threat. And so I think Mossy would have acknowledged that this wasn't a mistake. So little things I remember about Professor Mossy. One, driving. He was a disaster as a driver because he loved to talk. And not only did he love to talk, he loved to talk facing people in the back seat. And I remember my poor mother ducking three quarters of the time and being in terror that, you know, as Professor Moss, he'd go off and he had his hands flying around as he was talking. And then there was this a story. The nuns down at what is now the SSM, St. Mary's Hospital, some of them took Mossy's classes. And so Mossy is driving a former student of his from who had gone on to Time Magazine. He's driving this student around the campus. And he's driving fast, which is the other thing. He drove fast facing the rear. Professor Mossy is getting stopped by the local constabulary. And Mossy says, take this. And he goes to the student. He hits him in the stomach. And he says, bend over. And the student, this former student of his does. And then Mossy says to the police, I have a former student who's suffering an appendectomy. And the police escort him to St. Mary's Hospital, where the nuns who had been his former students greet him. The police leave. And Mossy says to him, you can relax now. So, you know. And the other thing I knew about Mossy, a little side story, is that very early on in his career at University of Iowa, he was there like in the very late 40s, and he ran for political office on the Progressive Party ticket for dog catcher in Iowa City. Was elected, and then promptly quit the job. You know, well, Henry Wallace was from Iowa. You know, he ran as president of the Progressive Party ticket. So, what do I know about Mossy? Incredibly gracious guy. Even years after I had been a student, my son came up to UW, and you know, Mossy again graciously took us out. And every time I took my kids up to a camp, what post camp, because they didn't have money to send them to the regular camp, I would stop at Mossy's house, and he would. Greet us again with Schnitzy, who was getting older at that point. So let me think a little more about him. Well, he definitely got me, you know, I was sort of predisposed to history, but he got me involved. And I think of Professor Mossy looking at the United States now and seeing, I wouldn't say, you know, he would not draw absolute equivalence, but he would certainly draw parallels between the dysfunction between the American rural fundamentalist Christian, I would say, sort of tainted fundamentalists, because they've identified themselves now with the state, which would be anti-fundamentalist if you look at real fundamentalism. Certainly Baptists were anti-state, but they have certainly tied themselves. But this utter split between sort of what I call urban skeptics and rural believers, which have been very much, you know, and this appeal to a combination of fear by the leaders of the Republican Party, which is not just, doesn't just go to Trump, it goes even earlier. Republican Party tying themselves to the South, which I felt very strongly was a disaster. And then this sort of rural resentments about change, their loss of sort of position, this sort of latent and now sort of more public racism by the rural South, very much sort of, and this demand that, you know, by the president of the sort of the national anthem, it becomes a politicized issue about whether you sing it or not. I would see Professor Mossy looking at this with a, geez, this is happening very much in my world, because that's what he, you know, his history was about, I think, you know, it was sort of like Berlin versus the rest of Germany. and it was the Berlin of Marlene Dietrich and Kurt Weill. Actually, there's a good television show, Berlin. Have you seen it?
Babylon Berlin.
Yes.
Great show.
And it's sort of like Mossy on television,
Yeah.
you know. And I'm saying, I'm looking at it, and I just stumbled into that show, and I thought, wow, this is very much the sort of the Moss. He would have recognized that show. Whoever put it together was brilliant, in capturing this sort of urban, you know, what do you call urban sleaze, free sex, versus, you know, this sort of righteous view out in the country. And so I think that would have been, you know, here, what would Mossy have thought about that? And then I recall his sort of looking at the campus, and I thought it was captured by the professor from NYU, you know, his,
Hacienda Diner, yeah.
yeah, his, Mossy's commitment to the institution. And I think that I think what he saw as dangerous in student movements, of which I was involved, was the risk, the people forgetting that forms and cultures are terribly important, and it's much easier to destroy an institutional structure that provides for all its faults and bureaucratic issues and human failures, at least a reasonable structure in which to do things that are, he would call good, and that if you politicize the very structure of the university, you destroy what he would call, I think you have it right here, slogans. You know, that slogans are a risk because they're easy to fall back on. And I think that's what he would have fault, not faulted, but would have seen in Harvey Goldberg, the risk of that. In fact, I brought him here. Let me see if I have him. Because I was, as I say, active in student. I don't have, I may have photographs of Mossy with my son as a baby. On the, because my son was born 1 week before the Army Math Research Center was blown up. And my, oh, I hope I didn't forget those. If I did, I'll pay a penalty. Let's see. Or I'll have to come back and bring them. I'll have to go back to, ah, but this is an example of what I think Professor Mossy would have. See, there's Ag Hall, student in Harvey Goldberg's class, and there's Harvey at Ag Hall at a class in the middle, right before the teacher, the strike in 1966, the first they call it student strike on the campus, and Harvey had turned his class over to discussions of the strike, which is what Professor Mossy would not have done. He said, "I'll discuss that with you after class, on my time, but not on my professional time." You know, and but Harvey obviously disagreed with that and was willing to do that. And this is a student at that class talking about whatever issue, I can't remember what he was talking about, but it was certainly related to the war and the war in Vietnam and whatever student issues were going on the campus. And Harvey is relating it to either, you know, the revolution in France in the 18th century, which is was his big subject area. So
And what groups were you involved in during the student protests?
I worked in Mississippi in 1964 in Ruleville and Indianola and Sunflower County. I was very active in civil rights stuff. And so in fact, I you probably didn't attend this, but my activism started in St. Louis between my senior year in high school, and I sat in at a bank. It was a sort of a seminal moment in civil rights in St. Louis. There were at the in 1963 in the banks in St. Louis, there were no African American employees at all the banks in St. Louis except janitor. And so this was a challenge by Congress on Racial Equality, or that was called Committee in St. Louis, to that practice, and we ended up sitting it at a bank that held the pension funds for the City of St. Louis employees. We thought that was the most vulnerable bank. And I did that 2 days before I came up to the UW campus. It was, in fact, we started the sit-in on August 28th, which is the day of the March on Washington. People came back to St. Louis from the march, and we sat in at the bank right then and there. And it was a big cause celeb, and went on for a good many years, including people put in longest sentences for contempt of court until that time, post-World War II. The leadership of Congress on Racial Equality. So anyway, that was the context in which I came to this campus. And just aside, they used to have what we call the speaker series. So they had a speaker series called Politics in the Mid-50s, or Politics in the, excuse me, the second half of the 20th century. So they had, among other speakers, George Wallace, James Reston of the New York Times, and a professor, ex-professor from Ole Miss named James Silver, who had been chased out of the Ole Miss campus out of Mississippi, even though he had been a professor there for 27 years. He wasn't born in Mississippi, and he was the only professor on the campus who befriended James Meredith, who was the first black student to go to Ole Miss, and caused a major riot. Professor Silver was at that point teaching at Notre Dame because he found a place there. And he'd written a book called Mississippi, the Closed Society. And it was really a good book, and I read it. And then I applied to be in the colloquium, which was a post-speaker event with about 10 students. And I grabbed a napkin during this, and I said, "Dear Professor Silver, my name is Chris Hexter. I'm interested in Mississippi. I've read a lot about it, and I'd love to go there, and I'd love to work." And I handed him the napkin. And I thought, well, that's dead. And 2 weeks later, he wrote me a letter saying, "I put your name to some white students at Ole Miss who work underground in the civil rights movement." And then a week later, I got a letter from one of those students talking about what was called a Mississippi Summer Project. Applied and I got in, and I worked down in Mississippi. So that informed my experience. And then when I came back, I was active in SDS. I was the first chair and vice chair of it. I was active in the Committee Against the House Un-American Activities Committee. And the irony in the 60s is that there was a newspaper, a newscaster in Wisconsin who was very conservative. And he wanted to talk about how students were destroying universities, and there were all these radical students. And Wisconsin was a fertile territory for him to do that. His name was Bob Segrist. And he testified in front of Congress about, he was the committee, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, which was the counterpart to the House Un-American Activities Committee. And there were a number of students in his testimony who were named as either communists or dupes of the communist conspiracy. I rated being a dupe of the communist conspiracy. And he named three incidents that I had engaged in that were examples of that. One was that I led a group of buses of Wisconsin students in my second year, it's after I was in Mississippi, to go to the Selma Montgomery March. Except the Wisconsin students, ironically, we never got there because we got to Chicago and there were so many student people pouring into Selma, the people that we were dealing with there. So we can't handle it. Please go to the White House and sit in. So there was all this core of Wisconsin students sitting in front of the White House in freezing cold weather in March, in the rain, and we had snow, or sitting there in front of the White House. We were on. The only thing that was really great about it is the taxi drivers in Wisconsin, in Washington, D.C., said that most of them are African-American. And we would say we had to either go to this church where we were sleeping on the floor or the White House. And they said, "Oh, you're the Wisconsin bunch. Get in. Free ride."
Oh, wow.
So anyway, Segrist nailed me for that. He nailed me for, they had a Thanksgiving, don't eat your food and contribute your money to, they had a project bringing food down to Mississippi. And the last one was he nailed me for chairing a meeting of the committee on the House Un-American Activities Committee at the student union. And the ironic thing about that is, although I was supposed to chair that meeting, I was chasing a girl down who went to the university, Indiana University. And so I was down actually in her, this my the person I was chasing had a good friend who lived in South Bend, and the irony, irony on irony. So I never went to the meeting that I was accused of going to. So Bob Segrist got it wrong, fake fact, and then I was actually with my friend, who was Jewish, and I'm Jewish by a sort of long combination of circumstances, and my friend's best friends, who lived in South Bend, were the daughters of former Nazis. I had Thanksgiving dinner at a house of former Nazis in South Bend when I was supposed to be chairing the next day a meeting on the Madison campus of the Committee Against the House Un-American Activities Committee. So that's me. That's not George.
Yeah.
But it's sort of a...
So you were politically active even before you took a Mossy course.
No, because I took Mossy's course as a freshman, his introduction.
Mm-hmm. But you were in St. Louis before university.
But I was, yes, yeah. I was active before I came to the university. So, you know, if anything, I would say Professor Mossy was a reminder of, you know, keep your balance, you know, don't lose it all, you know. But he had a sort of a limp. I think the other thing about Professor Mossy, he had sort of an Olympian view of, sort of a humorous Olympian view of all the stuff going on around him. And then I do remember, I'm years later, in fact, the last time I saw Professor Mossy was the history department here sent me a note saying that Professor Mossy was the first scholar in residence at the Holocaust Museum. And they had a program that weekend at the whatever. It was actually, it was St. Patrick's Day weekend, in or day after St. Patrick's Day. It was in Washington. And so I decided I wanted to go up and see him. And I called him in advance of going up. And he was, so he invited me to this place. And I met him there, and I met the husband of, she's famous. She was a star, and she went to UW. I think she got her PhD, feminist studies. Linda Gordon, and her husband. I think that, do they live here in Madison, or her husband was in Madison? I don't know.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway. So I had lunch with Professor Mossy, you know, he asked me. He says, "Well, you know, because he knew my dad." And he said, "What is your dad doing?" And my dad was very much institutional parliament stuff, parliament in the 16th and 17th century. And it was sort of like, "Oh, yeah, your dad's doing that." And Mossy was sort of, I think what Mossy was studying was the stuff below, sort of the, what are the forms that lead to these institutions? And I think what Mossy was accurate at is the forms can destroy the institutions. That sort of the guts of the world can destroy. And I sort of again see this in the context of the United States. So he was saying, "Oh, your dad's still doing that," which was this institutional stuff. And it was clear that Mossy, in his view, did not. I wouldn't say he was critical of my dad, but it wasn't his Mossy's thing, you know. And I remember also, and I reading his autobiography, I remember this. In his autobiography, and it was both in his autobiography and what he said about himself. Mossy was always somewhat careless about dates. He had to have a good editor to say, you know, "George, you got that, that's 50 years off, you know." Well, he's writing about his time at the University of Iowa. Mm-hmm. And again, a mutual friend of my father's and Mossy's was a professor, chairman of the Department of University, William Adelot, who was a brilliant historian, and my father in big fights with Adelot about. Adelot was one of the earliest historians who believed in computers as gathering data for studying how decisions were made. And my father and he were always in this debate because my father was not, well, my father had skepticism about the value of computerized research, which was becoming big in the 60s. And but I remember in Mossy's autobiography, him writing about Adelot's frustration with Mossy's sort of irreverence about dates. I think Mossy is sort of the sweep, the fact, the date,
broad trends.
Yes, right, yeah, right. So here it is. It's 9:40. If I don't get over and see I won't get a seat.
Okay.
So I'm gonna go.
If you have photographs of Mossy, we would love to have coffee.
I have a photograph. I think I have to dig it out of dust, because you get old people, you collect, stuff. They get dusty. But I'll try and find it. It's Mossy, I think, with his pipe and a little bit of spittle.
That's kind
of
perfect. Like
that.
Yeah.
With my son, who was like less than a year old, and then my son came up here and met him. But yes, I'll try and find it.
Yeah, I would really love to have this.
All right, I'll see if I can dig it up.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for
coming. There you got my bit.